It's 4:06. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Rob Ferret. Veronica Rickert is out today. Coming up in Wisconsin Life, we'll hear from paranormal investigators about their process, and we'll learn about some of the most haunted places in Wisconsin. First, state Republican lawmakers proposed bills that would affect when and how Wisconsin schools can raise money. Authors of the legislation say the bills are designed to lower property taxes and keep voters from being worn out by multiple referendum campaigns. Critics argue that the bills take away local control and make it harder for schools to raise money at a time when state funding is limited. Molly Beck joins us now. She's a politics and state government reporter for the Wisconsin State Journal. Molly, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me.
There are two different bills being proposed that you just wrote about. What are they? Briefly, give us the nutshell of both of those.
Sure. The first bill would limit when school boards can go to voters and ask to raise taxes to pay for projects. So they would only be able to go to referendum during the spring and fall elections. And currently, school districts can hold special elections in off months, so to speak, to do that, to ask voters for that. And that bill also would put a two-year hiatus between a referendum that fails and the next time that school board can go back to the voters and ask for them to approve a new referendum. And the authors of that bill say it's to, you know, hold the line on property taxes and keep, like you said, keep voters from feeling worn down from multiple campaigns because there's no restriction on how many times in a row they can go back to voters. The second bill would eliminate an exemption that school districts have to their revenue limits. And revenue limits are how much a school district can raise how much revenue a school district can receive in state aid and also in property tax revenue. So this exemption, which has been around for a few years, it allows them to exceed those limits if they want to pay for an energy-efficient project or product, and that would eliminate that exemption.
So the idea would be that in the current law, they could do that because it's going to save the district money down the road, presumably.
Right. The projects have to pay for themselves, and when they apply to do this, they have to show that it will eventually save the district money.
Let's focus on the referendum one for a bit. Now, you looked into some of the recent background on school referenda. We've had more of them lately, it sounds like, and more of them have been successful lately.
Yeah, absolutely. It looks like there were 206 referenda in 2014, and that's the most in at least a decade, based on the state records that I looked at. And in recent years, it's been about 76% that have passed. And I talked to Todd Berry at the Wisconsin Taxpayers Alliance, and he said that, that represents a shift because it used to be about 50% in years before that. And he attributed that to maybe a shift in public opinion and, you know, voters perceiving that there might be tighter state budgets for school districts. And they, you know, want to support the schools' needs, essentially.
Talking to Molly Beck from the Wisconsin State Journal about new legislation on the way in the state legislature, limiting schools' ability to raise money, especially through school district referenda. So what kind of response, Molly, were we hearing from school districts and the organizations that represent them?
Right. I'd say the most outspoken has been the Wisconsin Associations of School Boards. They seem pretty concerned that these bills might hurt a district's ability to raise taxes if they need to pay for projects at a time when the state budget, you know, I believe it added maybe 2% in the second year of the budget increase in state funding, and revenue limits have been frozen. So from their perspective, it's coming at a time when there's not a lot of new money for school districts.
And on the part of that law that would restrict this to regular spring or fall elections, has there been much objection to that as opposed to, you know, having them on otherwise random times where there are no other elections going on?
Right. It's the same concern about that, too, that they would only, school districts would only be allowed to go to voters during, you know, two elections. And, you know, the authors of the bill say that, you know, that's a good thing because that will ensure there's more representation of the electorate coming out to vote for it instead of having an election, you know, in January, one bill author said, where there's, you know, maybe 8% of registered voters actually come out and weigh in on this project that's probably, you know, a pretty big project for a school district. But, you know, I'd say the School Boards Association, that their concern is that, you know, it should be left up to the school board to decide when they need to ask for money.
So the other piece of legislation you mentioned changes that energy efficient project exemption, so schools can increase, go beyond their revenue limits for energy efficient products, as you said, that will hopefully pay for themselves. What's the objection there? Is this an idea that this is a loophole?
Sure. The authors, their number one concern when I spoke to them seems to be that, you know, property taxes in Wisconsin are, quote, out of control. And this is one way that, you know, if lawmakers want to reduce property taxes, it's difficult to do so if school boards can exceed their revenue limits for projects like this. And the reasoning that they gave were, you know, last 12 months, property taxes have been increased by about $30 million for projects like this. In 59 school districts. That was one example they gave. So that's what they'd like to do. They want to make sure that, you know, if school districts need to pay for projects, they go to the voters to do so. And the School Board Association, when I spoke with them, their concern was, you know, if they want to do that, they should, you know, maybe just make maybe stricter rules about when they can do this and how they can do it, and strengthen oversight of these projects instead of just getting rid of the exemption altogether.
And big picture on both of these, did you get a sense from talking to the school boards group that they're kind of feeling squeezed from all directions with this new legislation being proposed?
Sure. You hear a lot of talk about local control, and the Department of Public Instruction, when I spoke with them, you know, that was their concern, that this diminishes the local control that school boards have. That, you know, it's telling school boards when they can, you know, ask their communities to pay for projects that their schools might need. But, you know, from the bill author's standpoint, this protects the taxpayer from, you know, maybe the few school districts that in their minds are going back to voters too often to pay for projects.
I don't know if we're at this point yet, but is there any indication that these will go into committees and ultimately get votes, these two pieces of legislation?
Sure. I spoke with Assembly Speaker Robin Voss's office, and they said that the speaker had supported legislation that looked like the referendum bill before. But other than that, you know, it's very unlikely this is going to go anywhere during this fall session, but it could come back later.
Molly, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
That was state government reporter Molly Beck with the Wisconsin State Journal, giving us the latest on GOP bills aimed at changing the way schools can raise money here in Wisconsin. Time now for Wisconsin Life. T. Krulos has been interested in the paranormal since he was a kid. Although he became more skeptical as an adult, his interest in those stories led him to the Paranormal Investigators of Milwaukee. In honor of Halloween, Krulos tells us about what he learned hunting for ghosts.
When I was younger, middle school, high school, I was just kind of this weird, nerdy punk rock kid. And so I've always just really had kind of a love and appreciation for groups of people that I think a lot of times are misunderstood. They're not seen as fitting into mainstream society exactly. And I mean, those are my people. So I love talking to them, hearing about what they're doing, and all about their own little worlds. I wanted to meet a group that I could meet over and over again and join on multiple investigations and get to know the members pretty well. And searched the internet and found this local group, Paranormal Investigators of Milwaukee. They are a ghost hunting group. They have been around since 2006. They're very well organized and very active. They do a lot of investigations here in the Milwaukee area. And pretty soon I was walking around in the dark with a flashlight, trying to find evidence of ghosts with them. Riverside Theater was my first investigation with paranormal investigators in Milwaukee. I wasn't sure what to expect, and so I learned some ghost hunting etiquette. Like, you need to kind of tag, if you make a noise in the dark, you need to say, "That was me." So you know that it was a person and not a ghost making the noise. They do these things called EVP sessions where they kind of ask questions to any ghosts that might be present. So they'll say, "How long have you been here?" Or, "Can you tell us your first name?" And then in between those questions, you've got to leave like a 10-second gap so the ghost can respond. And hopefully, they're hoping to capture that on audio recorder. There's some groups that are more like psychic-based, but the local group here is more of a scientific, trying to get video or audio recordings. I really learned that night that you'll creep yourself out really bad. So, for instance, I felt this cold air on the back of my neck, but, I mean, the Riverside is a very big old building, so I'm sure it was not a ghost, but probably just a natural draft in the building. I also had kind of a funny moment where there was a report of, like, a shadow figure moving by the men's room on the second floor. So we were sitting in the dark, and then all of a sudden I hear this shh sound. And it scared me because I thought it was a ghost. But actually, it was one of those automatic air fresheners in the bathroom that, like, releases a blast of, flower-scented whatever every few seconds. So I did a good job of scaring myself that night. I don't think that we got any evidence of ghosts. The stereotype is really kind of bug-eyed, weird person wearing a tinfoil hat, you know. And I did encounter some of those people, for sure. But a lot of people are very, very normal. They have normal jobs. They're suburbanites, you know, teachers, scientists. And they just happen to have this hobby that's considered to be pretty unusual by mainstream standards, I would say.
Wisconsin Life is produced by Erica Janik. It's a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more online at wisconsinlife.org. Joining us now to talk more about the spooky side of Wisconsin is Chad Lewis, a paranormal researcher, author, and lecturer. Chad, welcome back to Central Time.
Happy October to you.
Well, I've talked to you before, and I don't know if I've ever asked you this question. How did you first get into stories of the paranormal?
I blame it on Wisconsin, because not only do we have the UFO capital of the world here, we have three different cities that claim to be the UFO capital of the world. So I happened to grow up near one of those cities and became interested in why people thought they were seeing UFOs.
And why did they think that?
Well, they thought they were seeing them, and they thought they were not only seeing them, but people were interacting with them in the town. Local police officer, local sheriff, actually was struck by a bolt of light that smashed his car, and he woke up missing some time, and the car's electrical wires were fried out, and they believed it because so many credible people were seeing and reporting these things.
Well, it's Halloween. We tend not to think of aliens so much as we were hearing that Wisconsin Life piece. Ghost stories. What are some of the best known ghost sites and stories around the state, Chad?
Well, you can't throw a rock without hitting a haunted place in Wisconsin. They're everywhere. And one of my favorites is a small little town outside of Menominee, Wisconsin, called Carryville. Even the name's kind of creepy. And it's this small little place where so many things happen within a mile radius. You have a haunted church, a haunted school, a haunted road, a graveyard, a boat landing. And many of the ghosts are a former priest that is said to be hanging in the tower of the old building. Some see a little kid in the old schoolhouse that was said to have been frozen to death on one dark, cold Wisconsin night. So a lot of people go here, especially this time of the year, and many of them end up with a ghost story. Some of them end up with a trespassing ticket.
I was going to ask about that. If people want to actually visit these sites, research them, do the typical from the movies and Scooby-Doo, spend the night in the haunted site, what's the right way to do it to not end up with that trespassing ticket?
A lot of the places that I talk about and write about are open to the public. Even cemeteries are open from light to light. They close officially at dark. But people can get permission to be in these places. Oftentimes, people forego that and just take their chances. But a lot of these places are open to the public. They have no closing time. Other than that, if you want to stay there, most places will let you if you just ask.
And have you spent a lot of time, maybe at night, maybe in some of the spookier haunted houses around the state?
There are places I don't like to go. People always ask if I get scared at these places. And I say that if you're not getting scared there, you're not trying hard enough. That many of these places are just downright creepy. They're in the middle of nowhere. They have that atmosphere you would think of a haunted place, that they should be haunted by all accounts.
Talking to Chad Lewis about paranormal spaces and places here in Wisconsin. He researches and writes about and lectures about the paranormal here in Wisconsin as we run up to Halloween here. Chad, do you do, in that Wisconsin Life piece, we heard about the paranormal investigators of Milwaukee. They've got gear. They're trying to record some kind of evidence of the supernatural. Do you do that sort of thing? And if so, what kind of tools do you use?
Yes. I used to bring a lot of equipment, whether it was cameras, night vision recording, motion detectors, electronic or magnetic fluctuation readers called EMFs, voice recorders, motion detectors. But what I found over the years is that I would spend most of the time setting up, monitoring, and breaking down this equipment. So most of the time, although my colleagues have a lot of equipment with us, I'm out there with nothing more than a camera and a notebook that I noticed I was missing the legend that I was out there and people talking about getting pushed off the haunted mausoleum and that I was too busy looking at equipment to enjoy the dares and the legends associated with it. So I'm out there a lot of times with little to no equipment outside of just some mainstay things.
So for believers and skeptics alike, Chad, how important are these legends as a part of Wisconsin's culture?
Well, all these legends that are non-Native American legends were brought over from our ancestors, the werewolves, the vampires, the ghosts, the hauntings, the banshees, you name it, the little people, the wee folk, all of these, and they're a continuation. And even if people don't believe in these stories, this time of year, they're fascinated by them. And one of the favorite things I love to do is monitor how these stories progress and move over the years. When I talk to seniors who remember back as kids hearing one version of the story, and then you talk to teenagers, they have a completely different version of the same story because it has changed over the years.
That's interesting how the folk stories are being passed down from generation to generation still. And we think, you know, folk stories, folk customs are a thing of the past, but you see them still alive and well today.
Yes, a lot of younger people take these as almost a rite of passage, that we don't have that in America anymore, that they can go out to these places and test their bravery among their peers, and almost as a rite of passage into adulthood, that they can show that nothing scares them. And whether that's wise or not, I don't know, but it's continuing on.
If somebody wanted to celebrate maybe this Halloween week, what are some good sites, as you say, open to the public maybe or easy to get permission to see, that you recommend people check out?
Yes, if you're in western Wisconsin, you may want to go to Mary of Elk Lake Dam. This woman who was murdered in 1974 haunts this secluded dam. If you're down where the Wisconsin Life was in Milwaukee, you may want to stay at the Ambassador Hotel. Jeffrey Dahmer, who many of your listeners will recognize that name, he had some events, let's just leave it at that, at the Ambassador, and they're thought to be haunted. You may want to go up to the remains of Summerwind, way in the north of Wisconsin, where previous owners were so afraid of the ghosts, they shot up their house with their weapons, trying to get rid of them.
And so where does Chad Lewis spend Halloween itself?
I will be at one of the first haunted places I ever investigated near Eau Claire, my hometown, 20-odd years ago, and I made it a tradition to go out there every night looking for this spirit on Halloween, when many people believe the veil between worlds is at its thinnest.
And do you dress up for Halloween, Chad?
Oh, yes, I have to dress up. You cannot celebrate Wisconsin Halloween without dressing up.
What's your costume?
Well, I'm going to make my good friend and colleague Linda Godfrey very happy right now. I'm dressing up this year as a werewolf.
All right, we'll watch for the werewolf near Eau Claire this year. Chad, thanks a lot for joining us.
Hey, keep an eye out.
All right, that's Chad Lewis, paranormal researcher, author, and lecturer. You can find out more about his work and about Wisconsin legends on his website. It's unexplainedresearch.com. Last week, Sesame Street announced they're introducing a new Muppet character with autism. Her name is Julia. She hasn't been introduced on the TV show yet, but Sesame Street created a storybook about her. Here's a clip from the online version of the book. It's called We're Amazing 1-2-3.
Elmo's daddy told Elmo that Julia has autism, he says. So she does things a little differently. Sometimes Elmo talks to Julia using fewer words and says the same thing a few times.
Apoorva Mandavilli is with us now to talk about Julia and the significance of this new character and about autism more generally. She's a science writer and editor-in-chief of the autism news website Spectrum. Apoorva, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, thank you for having me.
So what was your reaction when you heard about this new Sesame Street character with autism?
Well, I'm delighted that Sesame Street is doing this. A lot of children have autism, and a lot more children are going to meet another kid with autism at some point. And it's wonderful that Sesame Street is helping to think about how these kids can see children with autism are different from them in some ways, but also like them in a lot of ways.
Is it important, whether in Sesame Street or elsewhere, to kind of, I guess, demystify this for kids and probably for grown-ups for that matter, to get rid of maybe some of the stigma that they might otherwise encounter?
Absolutely. I mean, I think in the storybook that you just played a clip from, there are a lot of examples of things that a lot of typical kids do, like Elmo, I think, in the storybook, likes to stack blocks, which a lot of kids like to do, but a kid with autism might line them up and might know all of the lyrics to a particular song, for example. And these are some of the examples that they use to make the point that these are behaviors that a kid can recognize in themselves, but they're just maybe manifested a little bit differently in another kid. And I think it also helps parents see that these kids are really like their own children, and to help them talk to their kids about how to see that every kid is different, every kid has strengths and differences, and it's okay.
A lot of talk about autism is focused on causes and cures. How important is this idea of teaching other people how to work with, how to accommodate the needs of people who have this one significant difference?
I think the idea of a cure is very controversial, and rightly so. I think there are a lot of people with autism who need some help treating some of the symptoms that they experience. But the overarching message that I think people are really trying to convey these days is that everybody is on the spectrum in a certain way, and that we're all, you know, we may all have certain traits of autism. Maybe that's attention to detail, or maybe that's a sort of abiding interest in trains or something else that manifests a little bit strongly in somebody with autism. But ultimately, it's to appreciate and recognize and accept those differences.
Yeah, given that range of ways that autism can manifest itself, is it hard to take a one-size-fits-all approach to create, say, a character like Julia on Sesame Street?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's just no way they could have won on this one. You know, I think they really worked very hard on this, and I give them really major kudos for working with people who have autism themselves. My understanding is that they spent years researching this, and they worked with Autistic Self-Advocacy Network, which is a group that represents people who have autism themselves. And I think that's really important. I think a lot of things that come up like this, you know, the organizations don't take the trouble to really talk to people on the spectrum and find out how they want to be represented. And I think that's something they did very well. In this case, they picked a girl, which I'm really delighted by, because I think autism too often gets sort of painted as a condition that only affects boys, and that's absolutely not true. And, you know, Julia has certain quirks that may not show up in all girls with autism. But again, you know, there's this common saying among scientists and doctors, if you've met one kid with autism, you've met one kid with autism, because the spectrum is so diverse and the condition is so diverse that no two kids with autism really look alike. But I think they've done a really good job of trying to capture some of the core symptoms, some of the core characteristics of autism that kids might recognize if they meet another kid on the spectrum.
Talking to Apurva Mandavilli about autism. She's editor-in-chief of the autism news website Spectrum, reacting in part to the news that Sesame Street is introducing a new character, a Muppet, a girl named Julia, who is dealing with autism. And you recently wrote a piece, Apurva, on the invisible girls and women with autism. And I want to talk to you some more about that. We do, I think the stereotype, if you think of somebody with autism, you think of a boy, probably a young boy. Talk about the invisible girls and women with autism, please.
So for this piece, I spent a lot of time with some people who are considered high-functioning, meaning that they are verbal, they can express themselves, and they can talk about what their experience has been. And a lot of these women go through the experience of not being recognized as having autism for too many years of their lives. One woman in particular, whose story really frames my article, she had multiple diagnoses over the course of her life, and she was misdiagnosed with borderline personality disorder and paranoid personality disorder and anorexia, which she did have, but there were all these things that were masking her autism, and I think that happens a lot with girls because even scientists and doctors who you would expect to know more really think of autism as something that affects boys, and so they're looking for the kinds of things that you would see in a boy. You know, they're looking for an obsession with train schedules or an obsession with things that are spinning or these things that are very characteristically seen in boys with autism. But in girls, that might be an obsessive interest in dolls or in horses or, you know, something that's really very similar to what you'd see in a typical girl, and so it sort of flies under the radar for years before it's picked up.
And because, as far as we know so far, autism is more common in males, most of the research has been there. Is that part of why we're missing the condition for women?
That's absolutely true. I think the current ratio is somewhere between 4 to 5 boys for every girl diagnosed with autism. I don't know exactly where that ratio will pan out if we do end up looking at this more in girls, but the idea is that, you know, so far, because boys are the ones who've been diagnosed with autism, we don't really know a lot about what autism looks like in girls, and there's just starting to be some interest in this. And I think this is similar in a lot of other health conditions, so heart disease, for example, or things like that, where the diagnostic tests and the symptoms that you expect to see are all based on what it looks like in men and in boys. And so the tests that doctors use to even diagnose autism are really based on that, and so they're not looking for the kinds of things that you'd see in a girl. And even in research studies, most studies that we come across, the Spectrum is, you know, a news site about autism, and we cover a lot of research, and just about everything we cover, all of the study participants are usually boys or men. There are very few that include women, and even if they do, there are very few women that are included, so you don't really get a very clear, statistically accurate picture of what autism looks like in girls.
That ratio of boys to girls you mentioned, so that could reflect that boys are way more are more prone to have autism, but it could be that women are and girls are massively underdiagnosed. Is that possible, that the ratio could be much closer than we think?
It could be. Honestly, the answer is we don't know, because we haven't really been looking at autism in girls. I think this is something that's just starting to change, especially in the last, I would say, 2 to 3 years. There's been a huge amount of interest, and maybe we'll see that ratio change. From what I'm gathering from scientists who work in this field, the sort of more severe end of the spectrum, where boys and girls are really severely affected with autism, we may not see much of a change in the gender ratio. But I think where there probably is likely to be a difference is on the higher end of the spectrum, where the kids are able to talk and they are trying to cope. And I think at that end of the spectrum, girls who can cope are doing a really good job of masking their autism and of pretending that everything is okay with them. And so that's maybe where we're likely to see the ratio even out a little bit more. Right now at that end, you know, they think maybe 9 to 10 boys with autism for every one girl with autism, and that might get a little bit closer to 3 or 4 boys to 1 girl.
One interesting gender distinction you write about is dealing with the teenage years, tween and teenage years, can be difficult enough to navigate for any girl. How much worse is it? How much more complicated is it for a girl that age with autism?
I think it's just absolutely bewildering. I mean, having been through adolescence, I think any woman can attest that it's just confusing to deal with all of the rules in female friendships. And if you're a girl on the spectrum and you have trouble understanding these social nuances to begin with, it can just be completely isolating. And so, as you mentioned, starting in adolescence, these girls just have staggeringly high rates of depression, anxiety, feelings of isolation. Many of them try to commit suicide at some point in their lives. I think that's when they really start to fall off the social community, and that's when they really need help.
We're talking with Apurva Mandavilli about the new Sesame Street character with autism, a Muppet named Julia, and the difference between boys and girls with autism. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think about this idea of a new Sesame Street character with autism? What do you think needs to be done to help end stigma around autism spectrum disorders? Do you or someone you know deal with this yourself? And are you in a family with a girl dealing with autism, or maybe you yourself? Call in 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post over at the Central Time Facebook page. We pick up our discussion now with science writer Apurva Mandavilli about the differences in girls and boys with autism and a new Sesame Street character with autism, a Muppet named Julia. You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you or someone in your family have autism, what do you want the rest of us to know about it? What kind of stigma do you encounter? What could make it make life a little easier if other people knew what you were dealing with? Call in now at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We'll go right to a caller now. We've got Karen on the line in Madison. Karen, hi.
Hi. I just wanted to call in and talk about a little bit of what it's like trying to find and keep work when you have autism. Especially in my case, I'm on the higher end of the spectrum with what's called Asperger's. So I've been to grad school. I have a master's degree. I almost finished my PhD. So I'm smart when it comes to book learning, but when it comes to social interactions, I have a lot of difficulty. People think I'm bossy and they think I'm rude, even when I'm not trying to be. And that's actually led to me losing one job because... As a guest mentioned before, with women and female interaction, I was in an office that was almost exclusively female, and I did not get the social cues and just ended up getting fired as a result of not understanding what people wanted.
Karen, thank you so much for your call. Good luck in your current and future jobs. Apurva, Karen's not alone, is she?
No, not at all. I think Karen's story is very common among women with autism, unfortunately. I think, as she mentioned, you know, there are all these social cues that the rest of us sort of intuitively get and respond to. And for somebody on the spectrum, it can be just really confusing to read all these subtle emotional reactions people might have, to read their facial expressions, to figure out when they're saying too much, when to stop talking, when to, you know, look at people, when to look away. It's just absolutely dizzying and confusing. And I think that makes it very hard to function in a workplace or at a party or in any sort of social setting where you're required to be processing these sorts of social cues on a continuous basis.
Karen, thanks for that call. Apurva, one thing you write about in talking to some of the people in your piece is that some of the women have figured out how to work around those social cues. They've kind of basically put out flow charts, almost mental flow charts. But it's exhausting. It's something that's really draining to have to do all the time.
Yeah, and it's, you know, it's like they try to figure out the rules as if it's a system and you can learn the system. And you can, to a certain extent. And I think in the story, you know, I talk about Maya, and she has some trouble with social situations that are new, like blurting out divorce statistics at her cousin's engagement party. And, okay, that time she learned that that's not the right thing to do. Her mother explained it to her. But the next time it might be something else. And so those rules don't really apply. She has to learn them for every single situation. And it can be exhausting to try and figure out, okay, I was supposed to say it in this situation, but not in this situation, and why not? Why is this wrong? And often people with autism really like facts, and they like logic, and not everything about human interaction is logical or fact-based, and that can be just really frustrating.
Talking to Apurva Mandavili, she's a science writer, editor-in-chief of the autism news website Spectrum. One very sad part of the story, women with autism at risk of violence, sexual assault, and abuse. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, that was a really hard part of the story to report and to listen to. The mother that I spoke to, Carlene, she's been fighting this horrific battle for the last few years trying to get support for her daughter, Lee, who is nonverbal, who really needs around-the-clock care, who can't really care for herself. And so the family is very dependent on these organizations to help their daughter. And yet, because of equal opportunity employment laws, this place where their daughter lives is now thinking about hiring male attendants, and the family is just beside themselves with worry about how to protect their daughter, and rightly so. And I think this is going to come up more and more, as Carlene, you know, mentioned to me when we were talking, because there are a lot of girls on the spectrum, and they're going to grow up, and some of them are going to need this kind of round-the-clock care, and it's absolutely horrifying that there are no protections in place, that the community, the society as a whole, is not set up to make sure that these women are protected, and that especially people who can't advocate for themselves don't have that sort of structure in place to make sure that they are safe above everything else.
Let's bring on another caller. Yvonne is with us in Lake Geneva. Yvonne, hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. Listening to the conversation, and as someone who has worked with about 60 women over the last 20 years in mentoring situations, I think I may have come across some people that had this issue. And I'd just like to say that I would have been very open to one of them saying to me, hey, I just want to make you aware of this. And so if I don't respond the way that you think I might, please take that into account, because it would not have made me think any less of them. And that way, that woman doesn't have to suffer in silence and try to go through all the effort of figuring out what to do. I bet there's a lot of us out there who would love to help if we just knew we needed to.
Yvonne, thanks a lot for that call, but that's got, Apurva, I imagine that's a tough call to make. You could let people know, maybe they'll understand it and help you work, but there might be stigma. You might not want everybody to know that. How do people approach that in the workplace?
I mean, there's that element that you might not want people to know, and there's also the element that you might not know yourself. I think in a lot of these cases, the women aren't aware that what they have is autism. They've been sort of muddling through, trying to cope and trying to understand, but because it's not diagnosed as often in girls, a lot of them don't really know that they have autism. So they're wondering why they don't fit in, wondering why it's so hard for them to have friendships, why they're not married, why they're so lonely, but they may not always know why. I think that's the first step, is to get to a point where we really, as a society, understand that this is something that can affect girls and women. And I think people like the caller who can now pick up on these things, I mean, that's the hope, that we raise the awareness to the point where even if somebody's not necessarily diagnosed, that we become more tolerant as a society of these differences.
Do you think with the help of this new Sesame Street character and more conversations about this, are we moving in the right direction for that?
I really hope so. There's also a documentary that's out, I believe on HBO, about some girls on the spectrum going to a prom, going to a dance. And I think there's something in the moment right now where it seems like we are really building towards some awareness and some acceptance. And I hope that's the case. I mean, with Julia, I'm not sure what the plans are for actually having her on the TV show. I know that right now you have to go to the website and see the storybook to really get to know Julia as a character with autism. But I hope that changes and that she does make it onto the airwaves. And I think that will really help.
Apurva, thanks a lot for being with us today.
Thank you.
That was Apurva Mandavili. She is a science writer and editor, and editor-in-chief of the autism news website Spectrum. She was with us to talk about the differences between boys and girls with autism and the new Sesame Street character, Julia, who will help kids understand and get over the stigma surrounding autism.